Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Travelers versus Bullock.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present argument to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 4 minutes for the vote.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case concerns Article 16, Section 26 of our Constitution, which, along with so many provisions of our Constitution, is unique to Texas. Concerning this provision, this court 118 years ago said the following: the wording of the Constitution is obscure and its construction not free from difficulty. That's true then, and it's true today. But when the historical context of Section 26 is examined, it becomes clear that that section should not be construed as the Court of Appeals has construed it in this case. In 1860, of course, the legislature passed Texas' first Wrongful Death Act. And sometime shortly thereafter, the exact dates are obscure, the lower courts began holding that that act, being in derogation of the common law and creating a new cause of action, provided a right of action for actual damages only. In response, the framers of the 1869 Constitution inserted a provision giving a right of exemplary damages in cases of willful homicide. And the framers of the 1876 Constitution extended that right to cases of homicide through gross neglect. There is virtually no legislative history, so to speak, of these constitutional provisions. But the contemporaneous holdings of this court and the lower courts indicate that its purpose was to extend and supplement the existing Wrongful Death Act and not to create a new cause of action independent of that act. Now, supplementing legislation through a constitutional provision is a rather unusual thing to do. And in this case, commentators have suggested that it was perhaps an inappropriate thing to do. But it nevertheless appears to have been the actual historical purpose of the framers of the 1869 and 1876 Constitution as regards this provision. And so I think it's a mistake to view this provision as though it were, for example, part of our Bill of Rights, a fundamental guarantee. Rather, it is stuck back in the general provisions as a means of supplementing an existing statute. It was not the purpose of Section 26 to...
Counsel, are there any other parallels in any other area of the law where an existing statute is supplemented in the, by the constitutional provision?
I have not found that. Certainly, there is no other state that has a constitutional provision like this one. But it is very rare for the Constitution to be used as a vehicle to amend statutes. And indeed, in the 1960s and 70s, when we were thinking about rewriting our Constitution entirely, the Legislative Council and the Constitutional Revision Commission recommended deleting this provision on the ground that it was legislation inappropriately stuck into the Constitution. But I'm not aware of any other parallel situations, Your Honor. It was not the purpose of Section 26 to alter any of the common law prerequisites to exemplary damages. Instead, Section 26 has been construed as continuing to require compliance with those common law prerequisites. One of those prerequisites is the existence of actual damages, not merely as a matter of fact, but recoverable actual damages under the law. And Section 26 preserves that requirement as well. Thus, courts have held that when there are no actual damages from wrongful death as a factual matter, Section 26 affords no right to exemplary damages. And they've also held that when actual damages may exist as a factual matter, but not be recoverable as a matter of law, due to some judicial or statutory impediment to their recovery, then Section 26 likewise affords no right to exemplary damages. That's been held in a variety of contexts, such as a statute terminating the rights of recovery of a child who was adopted by another parent, such as the situation early in this century when municipal corporations fell outside the Wrongful Death Act, and the courts said Section 26 does not bring them into exemplary damage recovery. Spousal immunity, which bars an actual damage claim, has been held to prevent recovery of exemplary damages, notwithstanding Section 26. In the Suber case, the Houston court recently held that when the decedent recovers a satisfaction of judgment during his lifetime, his beneficiaries have no right of recovery of exemplary damages, even despite the presence of Section 26. Instead, the courts have construed Section 26 as creating a link between the recovery of actual damages under the Wrongful Death Act and recovery of exemplary damages for certain specified beneficiaries if gross neglect has shown.
You're not conceding, are you, that Article 16, Section 26 creates a constitutional cause of action? Are you subject to the common law prerequisites?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. It creates a constitutional supplement to the statutory cause of action.
Well, to the extent it supplements, doesn't it create?
We're getting into a question of semantics. It provides a right that would not exist under the statute but for that provision. But in that sense, creates a right of recovery. But to say it creates a cause of action, if one means that that cause of action is independent of the Wrongful Death Act, then that's not so. If it merely means a cause of action which is an adjunct to that given by the Wrongful Death Act, then maybe it is so.
The legislature could repeal the Wrongful Death Act entirely. This would engraft onto whatever common law recovery was in. If we went back to the common law that was in 1860, then this would be dead letter. Is that your position?
That is my position with this qualification, that if the constitutional provision would persist, and if through judicial action or through later legislation a right of recovery for wrongful death were restored, then the constitutional provision would still be there and would have its effect. I think it's stretching the outside of the envelope to say that the legislature could repeal the Wrongful Death Act in its entirety, because that would leave this section with nothing to operate on. But I think actually that would be the logical result. I don't think it's likely to happen, but what is clear from the case law and the history is that Section 26 takes the Wrongful Death Act as it finds it, as the legislature may expand and contract it. I think the proper way to view this is as though Section 26 were a constitutionally supplied part of the statute, a part which the legislature cannot amend, but which ebbs and flows with the rest of the Wrongful Death Act. That is clearly the intent of the people that put that provision into our Constitution. And granted, it's a rather strange way for a constitutional provision to operate, but that appears to have been the intent of the framers. When you look at the scheme of the Wrongful Death Act, of the Workers' Compensation Act, you find that the legislature, in enacting Section 3E of the old act, has immunized carriers from liability for their conduct of accident prevention programs. And without directly restricting the recovery of exemplary damages, has indirectly restricted that recovery because it has limited the decedent's rights and it has limited the beneficiary's rights to actual damages. And under the common law and under the Wrongful Death Act, that has the effect of restricting the exemplary damage recovery as well. It's a confusing situation because in the analogous area of employer immunity, the legislature granted immunity under old Section 3 and then took away some of that immunity under old Section 5 when it said that you can still sue an employer for gross neglect resulting in death. In the case of accident prevention programs, this statute was enacted in 1963, and the legislature apparently believed it needed to do all that it could to encourage compensation carriers to conduct these programs. Between 63 and 73, these programs were not mandated by statute. So in order to encourage these programs, the legislature granted an immunity and chose at that time not to take back with one hand what it had given with the other, as it did in the case of old Section 3 and old Section 5 vis-a-vis employers. Now, the court did not grant writ on our points complaining that the Court of Appeals erred in holding this cause of action non-derivative. And so I want to touch on that only briefly by saying that in Russell, this court minced no words in holding that the cause of action for wrongful death is derivative and has been derivative since 1860. And it didn't, and was derivative at the time Section 26 was passed. And it didn't say except in cases governed by Article 16, Section 26. In fact, Russell was a case to which Article 16, Section 26 would have applied. It was a daughter suing for the wrongful death of her father. And granted, Section 26 was not brought at issue in Russell. But had it been, the court, to accept the respondent's argument, would have had to qualify Russell by saying the cause of action is not derivative as to an exemplary damage recovery by a daughter for her father's death. And that issue, that was not what the court said. And other courts since Russell, in Section 26 situations, claims by Section 26 beneficiaries.
Except Article 16, Section 26, by its own terms, does not apply, is not a right of action in the decedent himself, is it?
That is correct.
So to that extent, it's a right of action, if at all, conferred on the surviving, the survivors of the decedent. How is it derivative?
Well, just like the wrongful death cause of action is a cause of action conferred on the survivors and not on the decedent. And yet, by the language of the statute, the court has held that is a derivative cause of action. If, in fact, as we argue, Section 26 is merely a supplement to the Wrongful Death Act, then it takes the Wrongful Death Act as it finds it, including the Wrongful Death Act's derivative nature, which existed in 1869 and 1876. And there's no indication that in those years the framers of the Constitution intended to override the existing derivative nature of the Wrongful Death Act. Nothing in the very meager legislative history, and nothing in the text of the constitutional provision, and nothing in the contemporaneous decisions of this and other courts suggest that. No other lower court before the Court of Appeals in this case has suggested that Section 26 carves out an exception to Russell and to the derivative nature of wrongful death cases. In fact, the courts have held otherwise. In light of the purpose and the history of Section 26, we don't think there's any basis for such an exception. What the Court of Appeals has effectively done in this case is to make exemplary damage recovery for wrongful death into the proverbial 900-pound gorilla. And if we let that creature out of its cage, we can't control where it sits. If, as the Court of Appeals has held, old Section 3E must give way to Section 26, what else must give way to Section 26? Is it still true that actual damages must exist before exemplary damages can be recovered? Is it still true that you have to bring your exemplary damage claim within the statute of limitations for wrongful death? Is it still true that the decedent must have been able to recover on the date of his death? Could Ms. Fuller recover if we were able to prove at trial that her decedent were 51% or more contributory negligent? Or if we were able to prove at trial that he had recovered and received satisfaction of a judgment for his injuries during his lifetime, or settled a claim for his injuries, or let the statute of limitations run during his lifetime on his claim? This court has held in all of those situations that the decedent's right of action or his loss of the right of action derivatively bars the wrongful death claimant's recovery. And if Article 16, Section 26 is to be an exception or a distinction of all of those cases, it is a very, very major distinction which will revolutionize our law. A century of jurisprudence under the Wrongful Death Act will have to be reexamined, because I can identify no limiting principle that would say that old Section 3E must give way, but all of these other statutory and judicially created bars to recovery need not give way. There's no basis in the history or purpose of Section 26 for such a radical result, and we believe that it's unwarranted. And for that reason, we believe that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Alto Watson III will present argument for respondent. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. As the Sergeant Arms said, my name is Alto Watson. I'm from Beaumont, Texas. This is my very first argument in front of this body, with the exception of Justice Cornyn, who taught me trial advocacy at St. Mary's University about 10 years ago.
We won't hold that against you.
And
better do good.
I think that we miss a point here. It's the most unique argument that I've ever heard, that a constitutional provision actually supplements a statute. I think, as this court is well aware, constitutions do not supplement statutes. They control statutes and the language and the implementation of same. It's a little bit different than the statute itself. You look to the Constitution to determine whether the statute as written is constitutional. That is why it is in the Constitution. You cannot supplement a statute with a constitutional provision. The constitutional provision controls the statutory interpretation. My argument is going to look at three different things here. One, the analysis that this court must use in this summary judgment proceeding, the Constitution and the statute, and looking at them as a whole. The analysis that this court must use in this particular case, and standing before you today, is that our pleadings must be taken as true, that this particular insurance company, in a grossly negligent fashion, killed men. That has to be taken as true. There's no other way to analyze it. And as a result of that gross negligence, they should be held responsible. I listened to the argument. I read the brief. I read the amicus brief that was filed 2 days ago. I have not found or seen a statute, a case, an administrative law, or anything else in this state that allows a firm, corporation, or person to escape liability for gross negligence in the cause of a death. Even the workers' compensation statute itself, which was designed to protect employers from lawsuits by their employees, allows a cause of action for gross negligence. It's specifically included in that. The argument of the petitioner is that the statute took away and gave at the same time. It took away in Section 3 the employee's cause of action against the employer, but in Section 5 it said, well, wait a second, we're going to let you have a cause of action for gross negligence. That is not what the legislature did in 1917. You have to look at the 1872 constitutional provision, the 1917 legislation as passed, and then the 1963 legislation, which exempted this insurance company from any and all causes of action brought in regards to the inspection of the premises.
Counsel, are we to just overrule Rich versus City of Austin?
In Rich versus City of Austin, what you have there, if you're looking at a common law cause of action, you have to remember the king could do no wrong. So the idea was this was a municipal corporation. The analysis that was being used there is that the, quote, municipal corporation was not a corporation that was being used in 1872 when that particular law was passed. Furthermore, you have to go all the way back to England to recognize that the king could do no wrong. You're dealing with municipal liability at that point, which is a specifically limited area or access to the law, which back in 1872 there was no cause of action.
Mr. Watson, I wonder, back to your first statement that constitutions do not supplement statutes, I'm wondering, the Texas Constitution, especially of 1876, has been likened to a code because it is far more specific than, for example, the United States Constitution is. Is it, are you saying as a general principle that any statute that's in conflict with a code-like constitution, like the Texas Constitution of 1876, is just should be treated the same as perhaps a federal constitutional model, which is far more broad and less specific.
And I think that's why you have to look specifically at where this particular provision was placed. It was placed in the general provisions, an idea that controls the entire Constitution versus the 1876 constitutional things you're talking about. When you have a general provision, it's going to control all of the specific provisions that are there. I have some handouts. I wanted to have the court take a look at them because one thing that has not been briefed by either side and something that no one has looked at or reviewed in this particular legislation is that Section 3, the article which added this particular provision in 1963, was an amendment to the regular article. It added a section which said the association, its agent, servant, or employee shall have no liability with respect to an accident based on the allegation that such accident was caused or could have been prevented by a program or inspection. This particular article was amended in March of that year and added what was called, what we now know as Section F. I went over to the archives today and actually copied it. And part of this particular provision has a very important amendment which was added to this particular article, which states, Section F, no part of this section is intended to lessen or alter the employee's existing rights or cause of action, either against his employer, its subscriber, or any third party. Now, I think there was a reason that this was added, because it was not in the original bill. The reason why it was added is because, as to the employer, in 1963, there was clearly a recognized cause of action for exemplary damage, wrongful death, as in Section 5. As against any third party, in 1917, the legislature enacted as part of the act the third party liability part of this particular statute. But what cause of action in 1963 was there against an insurance company by an employee? This particular Section 3 completely deleted any cause of action he had for inspection. There was no cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. There was no cause of action for violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. There was no cause of action for Article 2121 of the Insurance Code. Section 3 specifically took away the cause of action that the employee had for 56 years against an insurance company because it wasn't part of the statute. What other cause of action or existing right did an employee have at that time? It clearly has to be Article 16, Section 26 of the Constitution. What else could the legislature have been talking about? I challenge the court, I challenge the petitioner to come up here and come up with any cause of action that existed in 1963 for an employee against a subscribing insurance company with the exception of workers' compensation at that time. And that was taken care of in the sentence in front of it, which says, however, this immunity shall not affect the liability of the association for compensation or as otherwise provided in this law. I think there is no doubt that the legislature, when analyzing this, took a look at the fact there was a constitutional provision which prohibited anyone from taking away your cause of action for a grossly negligent wrongful death. If you look at 83065, one of the last arguments that I would point to, I have a handout which was filed today, which I typed up myself, which looks at 83065 and the Texas Constitution. When 83065 was passed in 1917, they took the language of the Constitution in pointing out that nothing in the workers' compensation statute shall be taken or held to prohibit the recovery of exemplary damages. And they used the same language. I've highlighted the language, the surviving husband, widows, heirs of his or her body, or such of them as there may be, for a homicide through willful act, omission, or gross neglect. They weren't taking away and adding to in 1917. They were merely taking away and telling everyone else that, by the way, if you kill someone in a grossly negligent fashion, you will be held responsible in this state. It is a unique provision. No other state has it. I read every constitution of every single state before I came here. No one has this particular protection for the widows and the orphans and the surviving husbands as this state does. And it goes back to the state as a nation. It goes back to the fact that we have a homestead provision and a homestead protection, which no other state has.
You heard Mr. Young argue that if the liability as you see it under the constitutional provision cannot be affected by a statute like the one in this case, then there is no principle that would keep anything from limiting the constitutional provision, such as limitations, the derivative nature of the action, some plea and bar, or anything like that. What's your response to that?
I think that the Constitution itself puts a one-year statute of limitations on homicides itself, and later on in the same section, that may be a statute of limitations that they're referring to. But even in Ingersoll Rand, what this court, in Russell versus Ingersoll Rand, what this court was looking at was someone who was trying to revive a cause of action that had already passed long, long ago, some 10 years ago. And probably the policy there is good. If someone is injured and lingers for 20 years, is it right to allow his wrongful death beneficiaries 20 years later to bring a cause of action for wrongful death after people's minds have faded, after you have no other way to do that and people have forgotten about it?
The policy may be great, but the question is, does your argument leave any principle that would serve as a limitation of the constitutional provision like that?
Are we looking at statute of limitations or any other provision?
Those kinds of things. Any limitation on the constitutional actions you see?
Well, the first thing you have to prove is gross neglect, which this court has recently even upped as something that has to be something of conscious indifference. That's one thing that you can't get it for just neglect.
Apart from that, his argument was that there are many such limitations, not just Section 3. And if Section 3 won't limit it, then nothing, there's no principle that would let anything limit it. And
Section 3, and of course in our position, Section 3 does not limit it in any way. Section 3 only takes away the vast majority of the cause of action that you had for 56 years under Section 3.
So your position is nothing could limit it?
I believe limitations could limit it. I believe you have to bring that cause of action within a specified limited amount of time. And the Constitution has a one-year statute of limitations for this particular action.
For this action?
It has it right directly for homicide in the Constitution.
There'd be no need to prove actual damages to get gross negligence.
Not under Wright versus Gifford Hill. You only have to show the right that it did exist, that you could have it. And it would be the same thing with the Wrongful Death Act under 8306-3 and 8306-5. That they don't, under 8306-3, you have no cause of action for death. You have no cause of action for injury as against your employer. Those have been taken away. There is no actual damage that a dead employee can bring or a survivor. Only the cause of action can be brought. It's only for gross neglect, and that's what we're looking at here. Can a company...
the daughter has greater rights than her father.
No, the daughter has no greater rights than the father. The daughter has much less rights than the father did, other
so
than the
father
death.
Father cannot bring this cause of action.
That's right. The father has...
Had he lived.
Had he lived, he would not have a cause of action against this particular entity had he lived. But the idea is, can you kill somebody by gross neglect and get away with it? And the father has no greater right of action under the workers' compensation statute either, because that cause of action is also taken away from him. It's a mixture of the two. I suppose in concluding, the idea would be, is this court going to allow an insurance company to, in a grossly negligent fashion, kill somebody? Is that okay? Will this court write an opinion which says that it's all right, taken true, for this insurance company to kill someone in that fashion? And are they the only entity in this state which is allowed to do so? No other entity, no other firm, no other person, and no other corporation enjoys that immunity as argued by this particular company. This particular company wants to be completely separate from every single person who may, in a grossly negligent fashion, kill someone. I don't believe this court is going to write an opinion that would say that to the people of this state. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court. It's not just my words to indicate that the purpose of Article 16, Section 26 was to supplement the wrongful death statute. In 1960, the Texas Legislative Council said it appears reasonably clear that the primary purpose was to add exemplary damages for willfully or wantonly caused death to the recovery theretofore provided by statute in cases of death caused by simple negligence. In 1984, in Hofer versus Lavender, this court said, the reason for adoption of the constitutional provision was to allow for exemplary damages under the Wrongful Death Act because of the early interpretation that such damages were not authorized by the Act.
What about the fundamental, the axiom of constitutional construction that every statute conflicts with the Constitution is void?
Well, I think that is correct, but the question is, what would a statute have to do to conflict with this constitutional provision? We are not arguing.
Certainly a limitation on the right to recover if, in fact, this grants a right to recover exemplary damages, as argued by respondent. Any limitation on that would be a conflict, wouldn't it?
I do not believe it would, Your Honor. I think any interference with the express language, for example, this court has held that the legislature may not extend the class of beneficiaries of exemplary damages beyond that prescribed in the Constitution. Likewise, I dare say it cannot contract the class of beneficiaries. I don't think that the legislature could say, for example, you can get exemplary damages, but only if you prove an intentional homicide, because I think that this provision constitutionalizes the level of culpable conduct as being intentional or gross neglect. Likewise, constitutionalizes the class of beneficiaries, and I don't think the legislature is free to tamper with those. But if this is viewed as a constitutionally mandated part of the wrongful death statute, it doesn't follow that it overrides whatever other limitations the legislature may put in place in other parts of the wrongful death statute, such as the provision that says that wrongful death recovery is derivative of the decedent's rights. And so if you view this as a constitutionally instituted part of the statute, then it doesn't follow that it is on no higher plane than any other part of the statute. It can still have stature as a constitutional provision. We're not arguing that insurance companies should be immunized from killing someone as a general proposition. That's a ridiculous position for us to take, and we don't take it. What we're saying is this. The legislature in 1963 wanted to encourage insurers to do what they were not then doing, at least in sufficient frequency, and that is to go out and inspect workplaces and find accident potential before it occurs and correct it so as to reduce accidents in this state, to do what they were not theretofore doing. And it was entirely reasonable of the legislature to say, if you go out and do this, if you assume this duty, we are not going to let you be held responsible to the workers that you allegedly kill because you don't inform them of what you allegedly find. We are not going to, in urging you to perform this additional duty, we are not going to subject you to actual or exemplary damages based on someone second-guessing how you did. And so it is entirely reasonable for this court to write an opinion saying, when a compensation insurer is going out and doing what the legislature has encouraged and as of 1973 mandated that the carrier do, that the legislature was within its rights in granting immunity, and that that immunity carries with it immunity from a wrongful, from an exemplary damage claim as well.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the second clause, and we'll take another brief recess.
The audience will please rise.